Accession number 29054, Mr. Bim Wells, Reel 12. Now, what happened after then, after this incident?
We docked at Cape Town, and we were there for, I think, about 3 days. Again, the South Africans gave us a wonderful time, and I really enjoyed, went up Table Mountain, and we were in town, and this South African gentleman said he would like to entertain us, would we come out to his house and all this business, and they took us to a dance in the evening, and we had a wonderful time. And one of the reasons that the Indefatigable, which is I'm now on, called in at Cape Town, was to pick up about 70 brand new Hellcats, which they loaded onto the ship together with replacement engines in big wooden crates. And we left Cape Town and got about halfway up the west coast of Africa when a signal came through from the Admiralty to say that Lend-Lease had finished. And we'd either got to pay for the aircraft, American aircraft that we had, or destroy them. So halfway up the west coast of Africa, they stopped the Indefat. They got these 70 brand new Hellcats on the deck, issued the ground crew with crowbars to knock holes in the wings and the fuselage, and just shoved them over the bows, 70 of them. And all these brand new engines with those wonderful tool kits in them were just pushed over the side. You couldn't get the gun cameras, you couldn't get anything off them. And that was the end of Lend-Lease. That's how it was dealt with. And we then called in at Gibraltar, had a night or two there, and then we sailed for England, and we sailed into Portsmouth Harbour, I think it was the 15th of March 1946.
And what sort of reception did you get on your arrival at Portsmouth? It's a big ship. I mean, did it make a stir?
Well, when a ship's returning to it, Portsmouth was the home port of the Indefatigable. The Implacable's home port was Devonport. But they have what they call, when it's returning to its home port for the final time, as it were, they have what they call a paying off pennant. And this is a white pennant that they fly from the highest mast on the ship. And the length of it denotes how long it's been away from its home port. And as you can imagine, I think the Indefatigable went out to the Colombo and the Far East before Implacable. It had been away for about 18 months, and the length of this paying off pennant, I reckon, was about a quarter of a mile long. And one of the things I'd certainly done when I was in South Africa and also in Australia was to get food, tins of food, packets of sugar, anything in that line, chocolates. And when we got back to Portsmouth, of course, the customs and excise people came on board, and they wanted to charge all the crew, ratings, officers, everybody, with customs duty on this stuff. And there was very near a mutiny, I think. And I think the skipper of the ship saw these customs and said, look, these lads have been away from home for 18 months, most of them, and all they're doing is bringing a few comforts for their family. And if you're going to start charging customs duty on it, I should probably help them throw you over the side, I think. So they said, okay, we'll let it go. And I think I got something like 100 weight of food in my pack. Because I remember I piled up with this chap who was also from Leicester, and we came up from Portsmouth Harbour up to Waterloo, and then across to St Pancras, and got a train up to Leicester. And we arrived, I don't know, about 11 o'clock at night, and I think I'd got 7 pieces of luggage, and he had got the same, and we went to a taxi driver, and he said, you know, he said, can't cope with that lot. He said, you know, it's just too much to get in my taxi if I take you one at a time. So there was an army truck in the station yard, and we went up and saw these two squaddies, and they said, what you did? He said, oh, we've been sent down to meet a train, but it's not for about another 2 hours. So we said, right, we're going to commandeer your lorry. This chap lived out at Birstall, which is on the north side of Leicester, and I lived on the south side. And we said, we want you to load this luggage up and take him to Birstall, then me, and we'll make it worth your while, which we did. And so I arrived home, I don't know, around about midnight, and with all this luggage. And I remember the next morning, I said to my mother, I want none of you to come in the front room. And I got all this stuff out, chocolates, tins of fruit, tins of meat, and a whole load of stuff. And then I said, right, you can come in. And, well, it made me cry. It made them cry as well. They'd never seen as much food and stuff for the whole of the war, really. And we lived like kings for a week or so, and we were having chocolates and tins of fruit and all things like that. And it was a very emotional moment, as far as I was concerned, really.
Now, were you demobilised straight away, or did you have to go report back?
I was still on active service, as it were. This, as I say, this was about the end of March 1946 by the time I got back to Leicester and that. And but I, this friend of mine, he'd joined, I think I told you in one of the earlier things, he joined when the ship got out to Ceylon on the way out to the Far
East.
You
mentioned it, yeah.
And he then arrived home, and he lived out at Whittick, which is in Leicestershire, and his mother rang me up and said, you know, Phil's coming home tomorrow, we're going to have a party for him, can you come over? And I did, and we met up again for the umpteenth time since we'd seen one another in our basic training back in Gros Isle in America, you know. And we remained very good friends until he died quite suddenly at the age of 56. And I was finally demobilised in, I think it was July of 1946.
Did you have to report in, or yeah, did you get another posting?
I had to go up to Warrington, I think, and I had to take all my naval gear that I had been issued with. I got a naval watch and knives and this machete thing I used to strap to my leg in case I came down in the jungle and all this business, and these very nice, I got an Irving jacket, which was a leather jacket, fur lined, and we were supposed to hand all this in, you see, and I thought, well, it's only going to get flogged off somewhere. So they said, where's your watch? And I said, I'm sorry, when I was shot over the side, it was no good after that, and I was not issued with another one. And what about your Irving jacket? And I said, oh, that's been stolen somewhere in transit, I think. And so I kept my Irving jacket, and I kept my watch, and I kept my flying boots, which were fur-lined, and as part of the use of them came down in enemy territory, you could sort of cut the tops off and just make them into a pair of shoes. And I kept those as well. And we were taken to this enormous warehouse somewhere in Warrington in Lancashire, where there were rows and rows of demob suits, and you chose one of those. And
what did you think of the demob suits? I mean, what was the choice? How good were they?
They weren't bad. I think I sold mine to my uncle because I was a bit short of money by this time, and he was very pleased to have it. And it wasn't really my style. And when I got my final sort of demob pay, I went and bought me had a suit made to measure in at a tailor's in Leicester.
Now, that was me. We'll just get you back into civilian life. Well, what were you going to do? I mean, you'd had a job as an audit clerk or junior audit clerk.
Yeah.
Now, what were you going to do? You've come out, you've been an officer in the Fleet Air Arm, you've had active service, you've grown up, I presume, quite a lot. Well, what were you going to do?
This friend of mine, when he came home, he said the same, what were we going to do? I said, well, let's see if we can get a job flying. So we took ourselves off to London, down to what was at that time BAOC, British Airways Corporation, I can't remember, but it's BAOC. And we said, you know, what are the chances of getting a job as a pilot, you see? So they said, well, quite honestly, lads, we've got the pick of the RAF Bomber Command. Those who want to fly have got multi-engined experience. You Fleet Air Arm chaps have only got single-engined experience. They did offer us a job flying Rapides out in Iraq, I think it was. And I said, I don't think I'll fancy that. So I decided then I would try, and I'd always been quite interested in geology, and I thought I might try and get a grant to go to university and take a geology course. But trouble with me is I'm a bit too honest, and when they said what had I been doing, I told them I'd started off after I left school as an audit clerk, and they said, well, we'll give you a grant to carry on those studies, take a correspondence course or whatever you want to do, but as you weren't in geology before you joined the forces, we can't help you. If I'd have said I was in geology or taking a course in geology, I don't know whether they would have checked up, but I might have got a grant and gone as a geologist. But I went back to accountancy, and I eventually qualified as a chartered accountant, and I then went into commerce, joined a local company who then became a public limited company, and I eventually became secretary and a group board director of that company. And I enjoyed working for them. I don't know whether I was really cut out to be an accountant, but I didn't do a bad job, I suppose. And
you had a prosperous career, I mean, as an accountant and company director.
Well, yes, I did. I retired at the age of 59, which I suppose they were going to transfer the whole of the secretarial side of the company up to Bradford in Yorkshire, and I was a senior executive and due to retire at 60 anyway, and they said they were going to move it up to Yorkshire, and I saw my chairman and said, look, I don't want to move up to Yorkshire for 12 months, and I certainly don't want to commute up there on a daily basis. I'd sooner go now, as long as you pay my pension contributions for the last 12 months. And he said, well, I'll have a look at it, Dave, see what we can sort out. And they agreed to pay my pension contributions until I was 60, and they gave me my company car, and they gave me a lump sum. And I said, thank you very much, I'll take it.
Now, what about the effects of your service? Any physical or mental effects, good or bad? We're not just looking for either one.
I did say I had started passing blood shortly after we got back to Australia. And when I got on the Indefatigable to come home, I went to see the medic there and told him I was having this problem, and he had me in sick bay, and I had to give some samples of my stools and so on, and they didn't come to any great conclusions. But certainly when I got back into Civvy Street, I had the same problems, and they decided it was internal piles, and I was having to go for injections for these things. But I saw at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, I saw this, I think he was a Thai doctor or somewhere in the Far East, and he said, I don't think it is piles. And he sent me for other tests, and they said it was, in fact, colitis, which is inflammation of the colon, which can be brought on by stress. And I suppose I should have made a claim for a pension or something, but I think, and I've had that problem, and I'm still having to go in every 6 months about it now. I've had that problem for over 50 years.
Now, what about mental effects? Any mental problem, or good or bad? I mean, you know, did it give you nightmares? Did it make you nervy? What?
No, I can't say I had nightmares. I know my brother had nightmares from his days in Dunkirk and the Burmese jungle, but I didn't. I never forgot those times, and never will, you know. And
but it's not.
I achieved what I wanted to do. I flew, and I enjoyed flying, and I've only flown in a sort of small aircraft a few times since then. But I've got no, apart from this colitis business, I've got no long term.
Do you think it did you any good? I mean, do you think it made you a better person? I mean,
I do. It did. It gave me more confidence than I had in my earlier days. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier on, I was my mother was widowed when I was only seven, so I'd grown up without a father, and certainly being in the forces made a man out of me, I think, and gave me confidence. The fact that I flew gave me confidence as well, and certainly it stood me in good stead in my professional career, I think. The fact that I had got that confidence and was prepared to do certain things and make certain decisions, which I suppose is all part of flying anyway. You have to make split-second decisions, and you're either right or wrong, but you stand by them, you know.
Now, what about contacts with your erstwhile? I mean, were you a member of the... Because I know you were. You're a member of various associations. What associations are you a member of, and what do they do for you, or what do you do for them? I mean, why are they important to you?
Well, for many years after... I mean, I got married in 1948, and... We were then, or I was very busy then being a husband. We had three boys, and I didn't have a lot of time to think or get involved with ex-service things, although this friend of mine, Phil Meakin, who had been my friend during all our time with the squadron, he started farming over at Melton Mowbray in Leicestershire, and we used to meet up at weekends and talk about the old times and so on. And we remained very good friends, and our families are also friends with one another as well. And it was a great blow to me when, in 1981, he died of a heart attack, and he was only 56 years old. And something went out of my life when that happened. And it was... Shortly after that I joined the Fleet Arm Officers Association. Somebody suggested I did. And
what does that do?
Well, they publish a twice yearly news sheet about all members of that association, the stories they send in. And it was very shortly after that I saw an article about one of the members of our squadron who had been shot down over Japan and taken prisoner, and he was put in about a yard square cage, having been beaten up and threatened with all sorts of things, and he was in this cage next to a New Zealand chap who was about 6 foot four, and they managed to communicate with one another through these two cages by knocking on the thing, and they were eventually freed very shortly after the Japanese surrender. But I knew that he had been found safe and well, but this article in this magazine said that this New Zealander, who was a chap named Ian Darby, was coming over from New Zealand, and this was in the early 80s or mid 80s, to see this chap, who they hadn't seen since they're in these cages together. And I managed to, through the association, get this chap's, who was in our squadron, his address, and I rang him up and said, I haven't seen you for about 40 years, and I'm so glad you're still around. And we started keeping in touch with one another. And then when we got to about 1990, he was in contact with two or three other members of the old 828 squadron, and we said, why don't we have a reunion? And we had our first reunion in 1990, and there were only seven of us there. And we decided that we'd have another one 2 years later. And in the meantime, I sort of became involved, and I got on, at that time, Judith Chalmers, who's fairly well known as radio and television personality, was running a program about ex-servicemen and trying to put them in touch with one another. And I rang her up, and I was actually on her radio program and said that I was a member of 828 Squadron on HMS Implacable, and we were going to try and get a reunion going on a regular basis. And I, as a result of that, the chap who was my observer when we got back to Australia rang me up, and two or three other people also got in touch, said, I heard you on the radio. Yeah, I'm all in favour, you see. And so we then had another reunion in 1992 at a place called Dorchester-on-Thames. And we got about 17 members of the old squadron together, which was quite an achievement. And these reunions went with a real bomb, you know, and these lads, I call them lads even now, when they got together, all the years used to roll off them, and they used to come out with these stories, and they were wonderful occasions. All the wives used to come, and sweethearts and all that. And we used to have the one after 1992, we then had one every year, always at the same place. And there's one chap used to come from Canada, another one from Bermuda, another one from France, and they were wonderful occasions, and we had them every year up until 2005, when we decided that we were all getting a bit too old in the tooth, and we had our final reunion at that time, and there were one or two people who said that they thought we ought to go on, but I said, well, if you're going to go on, I've done my job as Squadron Sports and Welfare Officer, and 2005 is the last one, and it was, and I don't think we shall have another. They'd also had reunions, HMS Implacable, which I've attended several of those. In the early days, something like 200 people used to attend those. And they were ratings. The chap who ran it was a gunner on board Implacable on a thing we used to call the Chicago Pianos, which were a bank of pom-pom guns which used to fire. And he's organised these Implacable reunions over the years. Another reunion I attend on a regular basis is the HMS St. Vincent reunion. I think I mentioned earlier on in the tapes that HMS St. Vincent at Gosport in Hampshire was where all Fleet Our Arm aircrew did their basic square bashing. And in the early days when I started going there, there were six members of my old pilot's course there. And even going back to the days when I was at HMS Royal Arthur, Butlin Skegness, I was there at one of these occasions, and one of my fellow members of 52nd Pilots course was talking to this chap next to him who had been an observer, and he went on to say that he'd started his career as an air gunner, you see, and this chap, whose name was Harry Lowe, said, "Oh, Bim there, he was an air gunner for a start." And I looked across at this chap and I said, "It's Bill Orr." And he said, "It's Bim Wells." And this was the chap I met on Grantham Station on my way to HMS Royal Arthur Skegness. And we went to St Vincent together. He then went on an observer's course. I went on the pilot's course. And we hadn't seen one another for 40-odd years. And there we were again together. And he unfortunately died about 3 years ago. But we used to meet every year at the St Vincent reunion in London. And so, you know, I've kept up my association with the Fleet Hour on, and will continue to do so until I'm no longer around, I suppose.
Thank you very much indeed.